New Thinking Aloud is a non-profit endeavor. Your contributions to the New Thinking Aloud Foundation make a meaningful difference in our ability to produce new videos.
Thinking Aloud. Conversations on the leading edge of knowledge and discovery with psychologist Jeffrey Mishlove.
Hello and welcome. I'm Jeffrey Mishlove. Today, we'll be exploring the Marian apparitions that occurred beginning in the 1960s in the small Spanish village of Garabandal. My guest is my good friend James Tunney, who has been on New Thinking Aloud, I think at least 40 times already in the past, and I expect we'll do another 40 before we're done. James is the author of many books, including The Mystical Accord, Sutras to Suit Our Times, Lines for Spiritual Evolution, The Mystery of the Trapped Light, Mystical Thoughts in the Dark Age of Scientism, Empire of Scientism, The Dispiriting Conspiracy and Inevitable Tyranny of Scientocracy, Tech Bondage, Slavery of the Human Spirit, two dystopian novels, Blue Lies September and Ireland, I Don't Recognize Who She Is, Human Entrance to Transhumanism, Machine Merger and the End of Humanity, Plantation of the Automatons, and most recently, The Mythic Aim of AI, Maiming the Mind. In addition, James is a visual artist. His works have appeared in galleries in Europe. He is also a poet, author of a book of poetry called Mystic Murmuration. James lives in Gothenburg, Sweden, and now I'll switch over to the internet video. Welcome, James. It's a pleasure once again to be with you.
Pleasure is mine, Jeffrey. Always looking forward to our conversations, and it's great to see you again.
Well, this is an unusual conversation in the sense that it will be our second discussion of a Marian apparition. We've already done a program on the famous apparition at Fatima in Portugal, and what we'll be talking about today at Garabandal, Spain, never attracted as much worldwide attention as the events in Fatima.
No, and in well, there's a couple of reasons for that. One is it's not approved by the church in the same way. It's in a particular state which is described by the expression non constatat supernaturalitate, which is one of three categories, which essentially means that's not proven. It doesn't mean that they haven't found there's no supernatural dimension. It's just that they haven't finally pronounced on it yet. So that's one reason. A second reason, perhaps, is that it's a very critical message in some ways of the church, and that may be another reason why they didn't want to necessarily spread it. There is a challenge, however, a question about why the parapsychological community in the United States is not as interested in this one. And in fairness to the parapsychological community in Spain, they were involved in this and they played a good role in this, probably a better role than anyone else in this, or some members did. So there is a question about why it's not as well known. Although, when you look behind the scenes, there is in a recent book, a note that Neil Armstrong left a picture of Our Lady of Garabandal, or Our Lady of Mount Carmel, on the moon when he was there because his wife was interested, and there's a connection with Elvis Presley's daughter. So there's these interesting little connections. But no, you're absolutely correct in regards to the sense that we had a very significant phenomenon here. It didn't hold the attention of the public, and you know well from the United States.
Well, let's talk about the actual events. Garabandal, as I understand it, is a very isolated village around 250 miles away from Madrid.
Yeah, well, I have a funny connection with this, Jeffrey, is that at the end of the 80s and the start of the 90s, I was living in the north of Spain. So I went to live in Cantabria, which is the province, which is in the center of the north of Spain, as you're looking at a map. I went there about the time the church had published its second commission results, which had kind of basically dismissed the events. Now, I had known about Garabandal from Ireland because two of the seers, of the four seers, had connections with Ireland. So I had known about the events. I hadn't really connected it in some way when I was going to Cantabria. I'm not sure why I ended up there in the first place. But I was in that province. And at the time, the word on the street was that these had been kind of in some way disproven. And that may have affected the fact that I didn't visit Garabandal when I lived there, which is I had to explain to myself recently and go back over the chronology. But what I did go and visit a lot around Cantabria was the Great Cave System. And this is kind of important, Jeffrey, because you've talked about it before on one of your programs about the significance of this cave art and what it meant. And Cantabria is really the center, or one of the centers, of Paleolithic civilization in Europe. And in 1879, there was a discovery, a famous discovery, of cave paintings at Altamira, which is only, it's very, very close as the crow flies to Garabandal. Now, the effect of these discoveries by a young girl, Maria Sautuola was a girl with her father who discovered the paintings, was that the expert says this could not be true because prehistoric man could not have done these fantastic paintings. Picasso said that such paintings show that we hadn't learned anything. So what the result of this discovery eventually was to change our conception of who we are and how long we'd been on the earth. And still, they're going back over a million years in relation to humanoid discoveries in this area around Atapuerca, Burgos, and in the caves in Cantabria. So I was interested in those. And I don't think that people who have been looking at the religious or spiritual aspect have sufficiently understood how significant the archaeological context is, and the sense, for example, 35,000 years ago, there's a great efflorescence of cave paintings, and there is some implication that there was this jumps somehow in society, and I think I fit this into that context.
Back to the little village of Garabandal, I gather it was quite isolated.
Yeah. So to be more specific, therefore, so what you have to visualize is we're up in the mountains, and these are very green mountains. The rainfall is higher there than it is here, for example. They get the rain coming across the mountain. So it's very green, it's high, it's isolated. They didn't have motors in the village at the time of the apparitions. They didn't have a proper road going up to the village. And even when I was there, there were some villages that were quite isolated. I was a bit surprised when I came across them. You were going back in time a bit, but this was isolated and very removed, and the girls weren't subject to a lot of the cultural influences that were afoot, and you know what those cultural influences were in the United States, but they were cut off from this context. So we're talking about a typical Cantabrian hamlet or village in a kind of Y-shaped, nestling in the mountains. And behind the village is a closer hill, which is important, with a little calecha leaving, a little laneway leading up to this hill. And the whole area around the town is surrounded by a great bowl of mountains, which may prove to be significant. But yes, it was very isolated. They didn't have a priest that was based in the village. And they had been very Catholic for a long period of time. They'd been saying the rosary for hundreds of years. So it was a very intensely Catholic place. And the last point in this context, although we have to remember the Spanish Civil War as well, 1936, 1939, was an area that had devastated even some remote villages, not here. So there is a context also of great conflict over say, religious issues in Spain that people have forgot about. But it's isolated. It's very, very rural. The girls live a typical life of girls who live on farms in a rural area in a place that was very Catholic. The whole name is San Sebastián de Garabandal. So that ethos was certainly strong in the village.
And you mentioned girls, so and you also refer to them as seers, and I presume we're talking about four, today they would be women, at the time they were young, and they are the witnesses to these apparitions that occurred, I gather, over a period of many years, and at a time when Spain was under the rule of Franco and hadn't really been well integrated into European culture.
No, and so the apparitions happened over a period from 1961 to 1965, and there's four girls. In order, perhaps, of the significance, we had Conchita, who's one of the most well known, or the most well known. We had Jacinta, we'll call her, who has become a bit more well known recently in some senses. We have Mary Lowley, who passed away, and then we have Mary Cruz, who's still alive. So two of them, the first two live in the United States still. The third one did as well live in the United States, and the fourth one is living in Asturias. The last I read about her in the Spanish papers in the next neighboring province. So Conchita and Jacinta are very much defenders of the status quo and what happened. Mary Cruz has been ambivalent and ambiguous, and although Jacinta says that she was in some way never as involved in some senses, and there are recordings and reports of her not seeing things that the others saw, and there was a different context for her. So there is a distinction. This asymmetry is not uncommon. We see it in Fatima, even with Francisco. He couldn't understand some of the things the girls did. In fact, when the Virgin Mary at Fatima was talking about Russia, Francisco thought that she was talking about his uncle's donkey, who was called Rusa, you know. So you have this asymmetry. So Conchita lives in New York, and she is very significant in this. So they're about 74. There were 12 at the time, and the youngest was just turning 11. So and when they were examined by psychiatrists and that, they said because they were so remote, they were probably more like 8 or 9 year old in relation to their mental designation, if you like.
Well, let's describe exactly how it came about.
Okay. Well, we're talking about June 18th in 1961, and the girls were robbing apples from the schoolmaster's garden, if you like. And so this is, again, a small village, and they're in the lane, this caleca, which goes up to the hill behind. And all of a sudden, they see what they describe as an angel appearing, who doesn't talk to them, and they are struck, and they kneel down before this. They perceive it's an angel. They've been throwing stones and doing various things, and that's the start of it. Now they immediately go back to the town, so very, very quickly, or the village. They're in the village. The word gets out very, very quickly. The schoolmistress knows immediately. So the word is out very, very quickly that they have seen an angel. And of course, there's the usual questions. Are you sure? What was it? Describe. And they describe a small being with blue and pink wings, and looked strong, but was small in size. And over the next over several days, there was successive appearances, but the angel didn't talk to them, and there was some sign underneath him, and eventually he lets them know that there's going to be an apparition of Our Lady, the Virgin Mary, in the context or appearing, if you like, as Our Lady of Mount Carmel. That's a context that emerges. She's identified with Mount Carmel in Israel. So that apparition appear, or that apparition occurs on July the 2nd. So, you know, a short space afterwards. And the essence of the apparitions, now from that time and in all the totality, we're talking about between 1800 and 2000 apparitions. This is something which is highly unusual about this context. She gives her first message. It's bookended. There's one at the start and there's one at the end. A first message and a second message with a lot of messages in between. And there is a little wider context that we're coming up to the start of the Second Vatican Council, which some people believe was important, a parallel kind of movement in the church that informed some of this context. And that's the start of the first message that we get. And in the first message, it's very, very simple. It was so simple that when it was read out, it wasn't read out at the time, the message was read out in October of that year, that the priest didn't want to read it out. He thought it was too childish. He thought it was, you know, there wasn't anything meaty in this. And basically, what was said in the first message was that the cup is filling up, and that if there was no change, there would be a chastisement. So there had to be a change. The first thing was that people had to be very good. Now, so in that context, there's a general message and there's a more specific message to, if you like, to the Catholic faithful. But I think we should bear in mind as a general message. So people should lead good lives, essentially. That was the primary thing. And if that a change didn't happen, if they didn't lead good lives, there would be a chastisement. So again, this punishment, castigo, we can interpret in different ways as divine intervention or just a description of something that what was going to happen. And in particular, addressed to the girls, she said that people had to do sacrifice and penance and have more respect for the Eucharist, the communion for the Catholics. Now, again, you can say, well, that's a very specific Catholic message, but really it's addressing one to the message of Christ, love God, love your neighbor, if you want to put it in the simplest terms, apart from all the ceremonial aspect. So it's definitely a general message as transpires through other things, as well as being specific to the Catholic. Now, when this message came out, the word had got out that this was going on, and the word got out very, very quickly. The church was examining these apparitions. Of course, they couldn't see them, but they could see the girls in ecstasies. And so there was thousands of people at various times came to witness these events. There was only ever one person that participated in the site, but they saw a whole series of phenomena, a phalanx of phenomena associated with these apparitions. Now, I think it's very, very important, and particularly from your perspective in parapsychology, that we separate the phenomenon which are there, are recorded, and have to be explained, and the message. So you've talked in many times about when prophecy fails. And so for many people, they say, well, if the prophecies that come out of this fail, the whole thing we can disregard. But that's too simple, because we still have to explain why we had such a range of phenomena that happened apart from this reporting of the message.
You said there was one person only at a time who would actually see the Virgin Mary or the angel?
No, I was saying there was one other person as well. No, they. What was interesting actually was quite the opposite, that there was a series of llamadas or calls that the girls, when they were separate, would have a series of three inclinations or calls to come to a particular meeting, even, you know, especially when they were apart, so they could sense this. So in most cases, they are there as the four of them. In some cases, they are different. And later on, it was only at the end, it was only Conchita, because it was a series of events that interfered in the scenario. But generally, we're talking about the four girls, and it was so consistent that they set up almost immediately a quadro or a square, a kind of little corral in the lane to protect them from the crowds that were coming. But we're generally talking about the four seers. In particular events, there was a little miracle, a materialization in 1962, of Holy Communion, the Eucharist on the tongue of Conchita, as she said it would happen. So she was the one that experienced that, for example. But generally, it was a shared experience. The one other person who was involved in witnessing the apparition was a priest who came on a second visit, Father Luis Andreu. And he came, he said Mass in the church, and he went up to the area. The hill has 9 pines on it, so it's referred to as the Pines. A lot of apparitions happened there. And he went up, and there's film of some of this, but he was on his knees, and he began to go into a similar kind of ecstasy. He was brought into this spiritual light that the girls talked about, and he began to shout out something like El Milagro, so a miracle. So he apparently witnessed another aspect, which we'll come back to, the miracle. And what's strange about this story is that he went home that night with his friends. It was the happiest day of his life. He told people that we don't have to worry because we have a mother in heaven that looks after us, and she's only concerned about us. And on the way home, he fell asleep. He was a man in his 30s. He fell asleep and he died. He died on the same night. This was early in the period, in 1961. So it was a kind of remarkable element of it. But generally, we're talking about the four girls going into ecstasies, going into raptures in the particular place, or in a movement context. A characteristic of this was that they moved around. But this was filmed, and there's plenty of film footage of it. And one of the reasons why they moved around, because the church didn't really want them in the church for various reasons. The church was cautious, and it closed the doors and didn't want things happening in the church, which is partly to explains the strange context of the phenomena. And that has led some people say, oh, well, they, you know, it's something diabolical about this, if they're going around in strange postures, moving quickly, walking backwards quickly. That is some way diabolical. But there are explicatory factors which help us understand that.
And there were many witnesses who would see the young girls go into an ecstatic state. Did the witnesses see anything else besides the young girls on their knees with their faces beaming?
There was a number of sequences or contexts in relation to these ecstasies or raptures. There was a lot of people who were really affected by witnessing them going into these states. So that per se had a profound effect on some people that were very skeptical at the start, because they were convinced that this couldn't be done by natural means, the coordination, the focus. And when the girls were going around, often they would drop down to their knees immediately, and the sound of their bones on the stones has often been described, and people were fearful they would be injured, but they weren't injured, but they were certainly in an altered state. When they were kneeling, from the start, they were examined by a range of priests openly and priests in secret and scientists who went there to investigate. And it was clear that the photomotor effect had ceased, that their eyes were open, that they were staring upwards, and they were insensitive to pain. So they were on a number of occasions, they were stuck with needles, I think it was a cigarette, pinched, picked up and dropped, light shine into their eyes, sand thrown in their eyes. It was shocking. But in all those cases, they didn't respond to the external stimuli. And this was consistent. So there were scientific tests, and there were some people who were really qualified to examine that came there. In one, the head of the Spanish parapsychological, the president of the Spanish Parapsychological Society, had a lot of qualifications, and he went there and looked at them and was very impressed and was convinced. And was convinced there was no natural explanation. So as well, so that's one thing, there's the states. Secondly, there was the movement, moving backwards, moving at pace, and all the time they're looking up a hyperextension of their neck and keeping their attention focused upwards. And they said consistently that the young boys couldn't keep up with them. Sometimes they're running up the hill. It's a strange thing. Sometimes they would fall into strange poses, like statues, in a type of rapture. There are plenty of reports of levitation. There was a physician who said that he put his hand under one of the girls because she seemed to be up off the ground and she wasn't touching it. There's different descriptions in Catholic theology of what constitutes levitation, from Joseph of Cupertino, and we've talked about that before, towards a levitation which is slightly above the ground, where the person appears to move without touching the ground. There's many reports of that. There was reports that one of the girls walked across a stream when there was a lot of people who was without touching it, when there was a lot of people around, when she was getting to someplace. And there was another aspect which was common, in that people gave her rosary beads to present to the Virgin Mary to kiss. This was a strange aspect of the apparition, that she accepted from the children things to kiss, crosses and that, and they were given back to people. So there's pictures of this where the girls have a big clump of rosary beads and they can distribute them to the people around them without looking at them and remember which one is which. So that's a strange thing. And sometimes associated with that, there was information about the person, or there was some kind of communication in the context about the nature of what was presented to them. There is a kind of psychometry involved as well that comes out through this, or recognition that something is a holy object. And also they did sometimes pick out someone in a crowd when it seemed random, and that when they picked out someone in a crowd, it was often in the context of the person who was a non-believer, who said, please give me some sign, and asked specifically for some sign. So we have a succession of reports of a kind of telepathic communication between the girls first and foremost, and between the girls and people who came there. And doctor from Barcelona, who I mentioned, he witnessed this when he was standing with a woman who I think was a dancer at the Folies Bergères, who didn't believe in all this stuff. And she was approached out of the blue by one of the girls with the cross, and it changed her life. So we have another feature, the opposite of levitation. I'm not sure what the exact word is when you become heavier. Lourdization is a word I'd make up from the French. But the girls got very heavy, and it was very, very difficult for people to lift them generally. For the other girls, they were light. So we had this fluctuation in gravitas, which was consistently reported, as well as the being in rapture and non-injury and all that. So what we have is a phalanx of circumstances and phenomena that are usually the bread and butter of parapsychology. And there is a bit of a challenge, because sometimes once you mention it's associated with something religious, people are not willing to apply the same interest or the same scrutiny to the events because of that. And I think that there is a kind of challenge. It obviously was passed with flying colours, I think, by this member of the Parapsychological Association in Spain, and his reports are good, clear, cogent, and convincing for me. And he had a number of experiences. He had his wedding ring blessed, and that led to when he was going home, he noticed that there was a smell of sandalwood associated with it, and there was these strange things that he noticed. And then his wife, who didn't believe, began to have some similar phenomena. So what surprises me sometimes is there's such a wealth of material out there on this, but it hasn't really been brought to a wider audience. There are certain people, like you know, that Ingo Swann was interested in Marian apparitions. There are certain people who have looked at them, and Fatima is well studied. And but in some ways, this is a continuation of Fatima. The last point, that from our previous talk on Fatima, there was meant to have been a revelation of the third secret, but it didn't happen. So these apparitions occurred about 40 years after the final apparition that Sister Lucia had. So we have this significant gap, and it seems to be, in many senses, consonant with the Fatima message and the La Salette message. And I didn't mention the last time about Salvador Dali at this period, who got interested in Fatima and did a vision of hell. A lot of people don't know about that. He became interested again at this period between 60 and 62, and made a confession after he went to meet Sister Lucia. He believed in, I don't know about Garabandal, but certainly Fatima. So we have a whole range of the events that, or the circumstances, the phenomena that you talk about. So they were engaged in a whole range, although they couldn't see the Virgin Mary. There was a whole range of associated phenomena, a whole range of healings, a whole range of conversions. A Protestant engineer who came, had been injured, was going to go to the hospital in Santander, but he was had been tested. He was cured after Jacinta came and knocked on the door when they were going around the village and presented the cross to him, and he changed. There was one of the people who were involved in an early commission changed their mind and said we didn't really take it seriously. This was a church commission, and some of those people had experiences with curative powers. There was a medal given by someone to Elvis Presley, apparently, for his daughter when she was young and sick, and it was believed to have helped. So we have all this kind of network of associated phenomenon associated with the central focus of the ecstasies.
I get the impression, James, that underlying all of this, there is a sense, as you mentioned, Vatican II was taking place around that time, which represented a major shift for the church away from the Latin Mass, and the Mass was now to be conducted in the native languages of each and every country, and there's been a big backlash against that. And the fact that the original messages from Fatima were not made public, although a promise had been made by an earlier pope, I gather, to release them, so that there were some things going on there very specific to the Catholic Church. It seems undeniable that something about the Catholic Church itself is interwoven in all of these events.
For the believers in the Catholic Church, they believe that there is an apostolic succession back to Jesus, and that the Catholic Church is therefore the most important organization. And, of course, to remind people that you met Malachy Martin, who was very interested in these stories and supported Garabandal. I mean, there were a number of people in the Vatican, despite the fact that there were several bishops who were lukewarm about this and left it in the description of not being able to state that there are supernatural events. There were people in Rome that believed in it, and there was favourable statements from up to the popes in relation to this, although it's the local authorities, diocese, who have the authority to make the decision, and they leave it to them generally, unless they see good reason to interfere. But the people like Padre Pio had an attachment to Garabandal. In fact, it seems that he sent a letter to Conchita, saying that Our Lady had told him that it was true. And there was skepticism about whether it had come from him, but Conchita met him, and he definitely believed in it. And in fact, when he died, Conchita was called to Lourdes, and she was given the cloth that was over his face because he wanted it given to her. And she was a bit surprised because according to what she had been told, Padre Pio would witness the miracle. And he had died and he didn't witness a miracle, which we can talk about, we have to talk about. And she couldn't understand that. But the person who was a friend of Padre Pio, a member of the religious that communicated this to her in Lourdes, explained that Padre Pio had seen the miracle because he was a great mystic, for example. So he had seen it and that therefore her prophecy had happened. So the as Malachy Martin says, you know what I mean, the way you interpret prophecy, you have to be careful because it may not happen in the way that you think it's going to happen. But Malachy Martin believed that the Catholic Church was being taken over, and he believed, many people believed, that what was happening in the 60s was a takeover of the Church, and that the Second Vatican Council was calculated to destroy the Church. And there's plenty of people, traditionalists, that believe that today. Now, the other people on the other side would say, no, it's gone the right direction. We have this background to it. I think I should mention, apropos your question, the second message which occurred in at the other end of the scenario in 1965. So there was a message, and this was given through the Archangel Michael, who was the original, that was the angel who originally appeared. And the Virgin Mary, in her last talk in November 1965, she said that she hadn't wanted to deliver it directly to Conchita. But Conchita was the last one who was receiving this type of communication. And all of them had various what's called locutions, or they describe as locutions, kind of communications with the Virgin Mary at particular times. But she had persistent apparitions. So by the time we come to 1965, and the Vatican Council had been ongoing, the message is different. The cup is overflowing. So what had been asked to be done hadn't been done. The message had not been complied with. The message hadn't been spread. And now the cup was overflowing. So that was the final warning. So we had moved in that period into a different phase. And in particular, and this is what was shocking at the time, and it's hard to understand. It might be hard, especially when you've been in the hippie context in the United States, to understand how shocking this seemed, this message seemed in 1965, when Conchita, in the last apparition which she had advertised, which she had let people know was going to happen, got a message that the priests, many priests, many bishops, and many cardinals were, and their flocks, were on the road to perdition. So that was a significant message and a significant critique of some elements in the Church. Which ones, again, is a matter of debate. But what was clear was that many priests, many bishops, and many cardinals were on the road to perdition and bringing their flocks with them. Of course, that perdition is another word for hell, if you like, but you can say getting lost, another the implication of the word. So therefore, the idea that this is some kind of message concocted by the Church is hard to swallow. There is an idea from progressives that this is therefore concocted by the conservative elements, which is trying to, you know, oppose the changes in the Church. But it's difficult to see how that could have been done. There were other elements in it, other implications for what the general cause of the problem was. She did ask once, there was a lot of words they didn't understand, they were told, and this is a common feature in the apparitions. They repeat a word and they say, well, what does this word mean? So a few words that she didn't understand what communism was, although there had been a history in Spain, and one message came true. And now I interpret this as atheistic materialism, because even in the church, the critics or the anti-communists say that it's a broader issue about atheistic materialism, whatever form it manifests in. And this is a long message in Marian Apparition. But the argument or one of the messages which came out independently of that's the specific message about the overflowing cup was that communism would take over the world, and there was no other elements about Russia. Russia was going to be active in this process. So there are other contextual elements, but the key message there was that they were on the road to perdition. Obviously, they weren't being good in the sense of that she had asked to be, in whatever way we're going to interpret that, and that now we had moved into a different phase. Now, I think one has to be careful, and also for the traditionalists or conservatives, they're two different kind of categories in some senses for some people, that they don't seek to own the message for themselves, that we all have to be careful about how we interpret things, because there is a general message. The general message is to the world as came out in relation to the sequence of events that emerged, that the girls were told about over the intervening period, which we have to mention, the sequence of events, which is and particularly going to occur because the message hasn't been complied with.
Well, I would say that the message that you have to change your ways or there will be a compensation, there will be a reckoning, goes back at least to the ancient Hebrew prophets. That was their consistent message. And I think prophecy throughout the ages has always basically said that you change your ways or something terrible will happen.
That's a good point. But thankfully, we get a lot more meat on the bones here and a lot more specificity when we go into the interesting bits of, and I perhaps should explain this, this extra bit in relation to a sequence that we can detect through a range of reports and notes and what the girls told us. Conchita said, and this is I looked up today just to see what they said on Wikipedia, and it's wrong on a number of details, as well as the emphasis being very restrictive. But she said when she heard about the death of the then Pope, John the 23rd, she said there will only be three more popes of our times, and then there'll be the end of times. And she was told then by the Virgin Mary that there will be one who will not reign for a long time, so it's four. So meaning that this Pope would be associated with the end of times. Now, the end of times doesn't mean the end of the world. It's interpreted in most sensible interpretations as the end of the Catholic times as we know them. That's the most sensible interpretation. It means, and that has implications for the world as well. So what we get from the girls is a sense of what's going to come. And in some ways, there's a little parallel with what we talked about in our talk on John Nelson Darby, because we have all the same language, if you think about raptures and tribulation. So the tribulation that is coming is associated with the dominance of this atheistic materialism and communism and Russia being involved as well. And there's a lot of Catholic prophecy about Russia and even Russia and Muslim states invading Europe, for example. This goes back to the 19th century. But anyway, so we have a time of tribulation in particular, or manifest in particular, for the church. So there's great tribulation in the church, and it seems that the church is gone, basically, that the Catholic Church is over. This is the time or the signal of the tribulation period. And they do mention, there is mention also of a synod, which is usually a collection of religious people associated with the church. And of course, well, not of course, there is a synod ongoing at the moment, which will report in October 2024 and will be radical. There's no question about this. And this is something as well that Malachy Martin said would happen. And actually, he said it in the context of He said that there would be a pope forced to retire, and there would be a survey and some kind of synod which would, or some kind of organizational change which would destroy the church. So he's kind of talking this same language as well. So, and here is the kind of very important aspect in relation to. So those things are going on, and that's up to people, whatever way they interpret things, to interpret how bad things are. But the girls were very, very clear, or has been explained, that there will be a warning. And this is one of the most interesting aspects of it. There will be what's called an aviso, or a warning, or a notice. And I think this is one of the most interesting aspects. Because of all this trouble going on, and because we haven't complied with the original message, we're going to get what's effectively a second chance. And the second chance is in the nature of a warning, an aviso. And this is to the whole world. This is what the girls have been saying, or the seers have been saying. We will have a warning to the whole world of the nature, something that is manifest in the sky. Malachi Martin always talked about look up to the sky to see what's going to happen. Remember as well, going back to Fatima, that the Second World War was initiated by Hitler looking up at the sky, at Eagle's Nest, as anticipated at Fatima, which is quite interesting. But there was the sky turned blood red over the mountains and down all the way to the Mediterranean. It's quite interesting. But in this context, there's different descriptions. There's some reports that it's like two stars colliding, but again, there's different emphasis. But the point will be, there will be a warning. Now, what does this warning constitute? It's also described as the illumination of conscience. So what has been predicted or prophesied is that everybody in the world, the entire population, irrespective of their religious belief, whether they're Catholic or not, not confined in the Protestant way in their tribulation to the special chosen one, everybody will experience this illumination of conscience. And what that involves is every individual being able to see themselves in the way that God sees them, being able to understand how they are seeing from God's perspective. So that is the illumination of conscience. And the implication is that this will be the thing which will change when people will realize that they have a final choice in relation to how they behave. And of course, in all the work that you've done, bringing to the public's attention the near-death experience, and with Raymond Moody, and in recent programs about explaining the collective near-death experience, well, or a group experience of the near-death experience, what we have here in those terms, I believe, is a prophecy of a global collective near-death experience, which in some ways is a spiritual, I don't want to use the word reset, but something like that, a rebooting, an intervention to help people be spiritual. It's intended to be a grace given, but nothing has ever happened like this. So, I mean, it's a very, very bold claim, but it does. The extension of the near-death experience in from the work of Pim van Lommel and Moody and all those, and yourself, etc., indicates a greater awareness of the implication, a greater awareness of the profound implications. So that's remarkable. The illumination of conscience will be followed within a year by a miracle. A miracle which will be notified 8 days before by Conchita when it's going to happen. And it will happen at Garabandal. So this is an interesting point about the shape of the area. So if, for example, Conchita said in 8 days' time there will be a divine miracle at Garabandal. You don't, now there is implications that it will be difficult to get to at that time, but whatever way it happens, you would have millions of people going to witness this, especially because the promise is they would see something that has never, would be the greatest miracle ever, and everyone that was there would be healed. It's quite a remarkable claim. And they would see something, they would be able to see it, it would be able to be filmed, it wouldn't be able to be touched, but it would be, could be witnessed at the pines at Garabandal, where the nine pines are on the hill behind the Kaleka. And that, as well as that, there would be a permanent sign of the miracle left at Garabandal. So now, if at that stage you haven't been convinced by the succession and the phalanx of phenomena that have happened hitherto, by the messages, by the warnings, by the illumination of conscience, by the miracle and the sign, if by that stage the world doesn't change, well, then the chastisement would happen. So the chastisement is conditional on our failure to respond to these interventions. So we can't really say that it's as threatening, perhaps. But this curious, and you mentioned, it was curious when you linked it back there to the ancient times, because there will be some type of reunification happening in the church, which will accelerate in some way this these events. Now, some people believe that that's the reunification with the Orthodox Church. Some people believe with the Protestant Church, not as many. And some people even believe that it's a reunification with Judaism, because some interpretations believe that the nature of this miracle will be a reflection of the miracle that happened to the Israelites, something like columns of smoke and fire at night, and will be a sign to Judaism as well. It's quite remarkable, again, speculation. But there'll still be some people after that won't believe according to prophecy. And before these events happen, even Conchita won't be believed, even by her own family. So there's an implication that there's going to be a lot of ups and downs. And of course, for a lot of people, God bless her, Conchita, if she passed away without revealing this, you know, when this was going to happen, that could cause a problem. But the key event is this illumination of conscience, and that's the key thing. So that's really the start of it. And if that happens, and if it did work, well, obviously it would be significant. Although, of course, at this stage, with artificial intelligence, with the global military industrial complex, with the history of PSYOPs, with the examples of what they intended to do in Cuba in the 60s, a lot of people are going to say, well, is this something artificial, or is it, that is actually the problem, that would be the problem with some modern miracle. Would people believe that it's a projection from the military industrial complex, for example, designed to achieve some purpose? So that's a slight difficult. And there are some people, I was amazed to hear that, I couldn't figure this one out, Jeffrey, that said that all these events, Garabandal, are a Jewish conspiracy. I haven't been able to work out this. There's a lot of crazy views about the thing. But
to see yourself through the eyes of God, to see yourself the way God would see you, is very reminiscent of the life review reported by near-death experiencers, where it might take in earth time only a few minutes, but they claim that they've lived their entire life moment by moment and understood not only from their own point of view, but from the point of view of everybody who was affected by them, either positively or negatively. That does indeed seem to be what it would be like to see yourself as God sees you.
I believe that's what it is. I believe that the description, and this was at a time before there was so much knowledge, and they weren't certainly talking about near death experiences. But later, the subsequent literature really makes that case. Now, we do have a bit of a problem sometimes. People have loads of associations with different words, and they can't interpret things. But I mean, there's very few people that dispute the literature or the power of near-death experiences. And I remember one of the first places I heard about this was when my mother described what had having one of these experiences and how powerful it was. So I knew what the thing was. Now, then you say, well, see you as God sees you. I mean, if you want to, if you have a difficulty with using the words and the way they have been corrupted or misused or whatever, I mean, you can re-articulate it in terms of consciousness and us being fractals of consciousness, and as Talbot talked about, and get out of the small conceptual box to understand that there are circumstances in which we can escape from our incarnated egoistical cognitive conception of ourselves to see us in the light of the broader concept of who we are, the consciousness, and that the higher consciousness, what I call the spiritual light, is noetic. It's capable of having intelligence. It is intelligence, and it's the same thing. So I don't have a problem with that. In fact, my interest or the persuasiveness of Garabandal for me was vindicated by the parapsychological literature in a number of contexts. So although when I was there at the start, people were very skeptical, and it may have impacted on me. I was skeptical about some of the Marian apparitions. Years ago, I began to look at, for example, the counter argument, say, about Knock in Ireland, could have been a magic lantern. Before anyone else was really doing, I was very interested in examining, you know, how you would falsify, I suppose, or what's the alternative explanation. This one is very, very difficult to find an alternative explanation, because the alternative explanation, which hasn't been really presented in any coherent or convincing way, would require a massive tissue of lies, a massive conspiracy. But it is clear to me that, well, we've talked about, and I've expressed it in terms of coming to the end of humanity, the humanity that have been living there for millions of years in the same area, that if we're at that stage, why would it be inconceivable, especially if you believe in things like the collective unconscious and Jung and all that, that we have a collective near-death experience? If you want to put it in other terms, there are other possible ways to explain that, especially if circumstances get very, very, very difficult. So I find it, I find the illumination of conscience something which is interesting to and easier to accept, and the references back to the miracles, etc., flow on from this. And we know that this happens to people. We know all that literature about people changing. And when you come down to it, what's the life review? What happens? You see yourself as other people see you. This is the essence of the Christian thing. It's the essence of, you know, love God and love your neighbor as yourself, or whatever. The reason why you're doing that is because if you don't, you won't be able to perceive the world from their perspective. It's a preventative measure, an encapsulation of what is a cosmic rule, that in some strange way, that our recognition of the other person is the essence of our being here, in some for because the consciousness is a reflection of a higher consciousness. So there is a coherent picture there. It does accord in many senses, in a mystical way, with the scientific literature. So I don't have any doubt that the illumination of conscience is a description of a mass collective near-death experience that will be manifest. And it strangely parallels a bit the rapture, tribulation, and the Protestant thing, which I don't agree with, but there is some there is some parallel, but this one is a better. I'm not saying that from bias coming from a Catholic background. It's one which makes more sense, and I think is more convincing. But there may be common ground for people to understand. And even then, if you say, well, even as the Gedanken experiment or thought experiment or something like that, say, well, what would happen if we were able to try and engage in this process of understanding our behavior from other people's perspective in a collective way? Surely, to God, that would help us to repair. So when they're talking about sacrifices and penance, that puts a lot of people off. But I think those words, in general, more general sense, are talking about a kind of cosmic reparation and a recovery, and a recovery of an understanding of who we are, and especially the supernatural. And that the juxtaposition we have is between the idea that we're merely biological accidents that have happened and therefore can be evolved and therefore can be controlled with machines, etc., or the idea that we're humans that have special capacities. That doesn't stop other animals having special capacities, but we have special capacities, and in particular we have supernatural dimensions, connection to a whole range of other entities and other beings. And G.K. Chesterton 100 years ago wrote about that very well, and explained that this was the crux of the issue. And he saw what H.G. Wells and George Bernard Shaw was arguing, and he juxtaposed this idea. He said that we are animals that need some kind of dogma, and that dogma is not a bad thing. A dogma of kind of love and charity to help us operate. So I find it very interesting, the illumination of conscience, or the warning, or the aviso.
I would say that since the 1960s, it's reasonable to suggest that there have been well over a million people who have had the near-death experience. And I think about 20% of those people actually have the life review experience as well. And, you know, it doesn't even have to happen to everybody. It spreads when you hear the story. People can learn about it, and something gets triggered in them as well. So I don't see it happening overnight, but it does seem to me that in the last half century or so since the Garibaldi apparitions, there has been a movement in terms of the consciousness of people on the planet.
Yes, and when I talk about technology, again, some people think that I'm some kind of Luddite and I'm not pragmatic about it. My basic philosophy is pragmatic, same as yours in relation to William James. So, you know, I can understand. I'm just want to point to the costs. But there is a strange juxtaposition, that a strange symmetry that I have seen in a lot of the kind of work that I'm doing, that wherever we get a great threat, that we also have a great grace that comes to match it. That for example, if you want to look at the apparitions in France, most apparitions in the world, the Virgin Mary, apart from Italy, have appeared in France. And that's the place where most battlefields in the world are. So I think there's a juxtaposition. So when the technology for resuscitation became more and more available, the technology that Pim von Lommel utilized to revive people, well, that helped in relation to the increase of near-death experiences, because he could study, for example, as you well know and have talked about, he could study these knowing that someone was going to die medically, and he could therefore study and report on these and systematically present evidence about this near-death experience, him and the other people, many other people that worked on that, as you have explored. So the threat, if you like, on one side of the technology is also occasion for a new grace to operate because of the technology. So the new ability to be able, in this context, to magnify the near-death experience, and even the use of the technology as you have used it to broadcast the near-death experience. I think it's one of the most convincing for people hearing about the near-death experience. It's one of the most convincing ways that people can begin to understand about it. So there is some kind of parallel thing between it. And as the technology becomes more and more intense, there will be certainly a positive grace which is created in opposition to it. It will still require that we individually make that choice between and are clear about and not confused about the choice, because all of those or the positive spiritual aspect of the near-death experience mean that the people say, well, I'm not going to be so materialistic. I'm going to be more aware of the other people, and I'm going to concentrate on the spirit in some way, without the, necessarily the religious context in the same way, but on the reality of the spirit. And one of the problems, one of the greatest problems with the Catholic Church and with all churches since the 60s, that they were heavily influenced by this materialism, so that I believe you can interpret some of these to describe a situation where the supernatural forces are saying, you don't believe in supernatural forces anymore. And this is the problem. Going back to the 19th century and Huxley and that, they're saying the problem that you have is that you don't believe in the reality of supernatural forces, because that's really at the base of all the other policy things. Do they actually believe this stuff happens or is capable of happening? And this intervention is calculated to assure us that there are a whole range of things that we don't understand. And an interesting final point, there is even in a letter by Conchita, I think, to a doctor, there was loads of questions. The Virgin Mary played games with them. There were so many that there was a description of fun in the process. But she did ask the Virgin Mary whether there was other habitantes of the universe, other dwellers of the universe. And there's not much in it, but in the letter, the Virgin Mary said yes to that, which is quite interesting and not sufficiently explored. What that meant is another issue. I didn't mention the Night of Screams, just one. In 1962, there was two nights which were tough for the girls. It's similar to what happened in Fatima, similar to not a vision of hell, but it was a vision of what was going to happen in the future. And they were, you know, they were screaming, they were distraught. They saw what was happening in the future and what would happen in the chastisement. What was going to happen, I believe, in the normal outplay of things, and what was going to happen in relation to the chastisement. And that was very disturbing. And a lot of people say, well, who's exposing children to that? But this is a consistent aspect of the apparitions. And that was a kind of influential part of the dark side, explaining that this was a serious matter. And again, in all cases, a serious matter which is self-inflicted on humanity, which is inflicted by our own actions and our own collective and individual actions. So, I mean, there's a logic to it. It's not about really the divine. It's about what we're doing to ourselves in many contexts.
Many years ago, I did an interview with the philosopher Michael Grosso, who also has a deep interest in Marian apparitions and religious miracles. And he wrote a book then called The Final Choice, which seems to me to be relevant to our discussion. He pointed out that, you know, roughly since about the 1960s, or to be precise, 1940s, when we developed nuclear weapons, humanity has had the capability, never before in human history, of destroying ourselves. We could wipe out all human life through war, through nuclear war. And since that time, there has been an increase in religious miracles, UFO sightings, altered states of consciousness, the widest variety of interventions that seem to be coming from what you could call the super sensible world, and they, or from the world of the afterlife, the world telling us, you know, you're possibly going to face the death of the human species if you don't change your ways. And it seems to me that one could view the Marian apparitions in the context of this larger global awakening, which we hope is taking place.
Exactly. Yes, I remember your interview in that context, and I agree with you. I think we can see this as complementary. If you're coming from that perspective where it's difficult to accept some of these things, they are certainly complementary. But one thing I would emphasize, it's not the technology and the level that we have got to in relation to, say, atomic weapons or artificial intelligence. It's not the technical level, which, if you think about Arthur C. Clarke and the psychomagnetic anomaly and the way that the technology is related to different stages and evolution is related to different stages, we have to look at the what these things are saying to me is that it's the underlying philosophy, epistemology, sense of who we are that's critical. Because we get all these nuclear weapons, not by accident, but by a process, by a series of choices, a series of philosophies, a series most particularly of emphasis on materialism and emphasis on the idea that we're not part of something bigger. We're not part of an environment that needs to be looked after. There is no other higher worlds. It's about willpower. It's about humankind. It's about so that's the problems associated with the Huxleyan, Nietzschean contraction into a technical vision of humanity. So it's the deeper thing that's been ongoing, going back to arguably, Bacon, you could go back, you could pick out some of these people that we've talked about. And that this technology now is the symptoms of the disease, which is deeper. And these, all of these, whether it be the certain UFO things, certainly, which is the spiritual dimension, and you've talked as well about the connection between UFO and spiritual light and the commonalities. Now, I say it's the same. There's the same feature, that there's a different level of light that we don't understand. And ultimately, there is spiritual light, which we are made of. So they are all consistent. They're not pointing to specific technology. They're pointing to what makes the technology. Now, there is an interesting, again, there are a whole lot of choices. There's two paths we can begin to go down. I did listen to your recent talks, your fascinating recent talks on UFOs. And of course, I'm always thinking about the War of the Worlds scenario and H.G. Wells and the New World Order and, you know, the Martians landing in London. So I'm very aware of that. And we've talked about Orson Welles and how this can be used as well. And what's interesting in the different presentations of the phenomena associated with UFOs is the different descriptions of where, therefore, we go. So, for example, for some people, they say, well, that means that we have to embrace transhumanism. And for Elon Musk, he's saying that, well, the reason why we have to upgrade ourselves is so we can, you know, adapt to these issues. And this was a constant thing. If we go back to Victorian Britain, and when we go back to Haldane and all this, we had to adjust technically in order to interact. Now, I dispute that. I say that all of the deep spiritual interventions, and another person you've talked about is John Lilly, and we often focus on the solid state entity, but there was also the good interventions that would intervene to help us from whether extraterrestrial, etc. There isn't as much in this, in Garabandal, about the kind of extraterrestrial reading of it. Like, there's much written about Fatima, which, you know, make a persuasive case of that it's a, you know, for some people, that it's UFOs. It did start off with a thunderclap, which was similar to Fatima, the original vision. And there are lights at certain stages which people haven't focused on a lot. But I believe it is what it purported to be. It purported, for example, people can easily believe that they're talking to their Uncle John in the afterlife or Napoleon, or they're communicating with some, you know, mechanical elf. But when you say, well, by the same process, this Jewish woman, you know, who is the mother of Christ, is communicating, say, well, I don't believe in that, you know. I mean, there's a strange inability or a strange closed mind about the ability of spiritual leaders to communicate in that context, although in Buddhism there's not, for example. So I think we have to be wide to this. So, yes, I do see a very... sometimes we don't get around sufficiently to talk about the hope of it, and I see a lot of hope in this if we make the right choice, and your emphasis on that choice is critical, because in all these cases, in the near-death experience, you're getting a choice to continue doing the same thing or to lead a different path. You're not being compelled, and that's a crucial point, because often people say, I don't believe in all this stuff, you know, because if there was a God, they would make it so compelling that we would be forced to believe. And then you say, well, then there's no free will involved in this thing. You know, so that's why we end up with a kind of a whispering God who is talking through the pines like a wind to young girls. And there is a question which arose, well, why does the Virgin Mary talk to, say, young girls? There is, it did come up in one of the reports that she says, or there's an implication, that all the important people are too busy to begin to listen to these spiritual things. And I find that very, very interesting. And there is that thing about being like a child in order to come in the kingdom of heaven. And I think it is very critical about our openness and our openness to spiritual light, the reality of it, the reality of the thing which is bigger than all our ability to explain it. We're never going to be explaining the thing. All of these, the ineffable is not a good word, as we talked about before, but there is something which is bigger than our ability to explain it. It we're unable to create a set which is bigger than the force itself, and we won't be able, we can only point to it. So that confuses people sometimes. They think if we can't describe it, it can't be true. But that's a kind of childish view of how the world works.
Now, let's talk about Conchita. It's up to her, I guess, to announce the next big event. I gather she's living in the United States. Do you know anything?
Yeah. The warning comes before the miracle. So we'll get the warning first. So at that stage, you're going to be more willing to believe the miracle. So it's the illumination of consciousness is the starting point. And then 8 days before, she announces, within a year, according to one of the seers, she announces the specific, or the miracle, at Carabandal. I think she's 74. As far as I remember, she married an Irishman, good taste, Jeffrey, and her Conchita, or Jacinta, married someone from an Irish background as well, so that's a double connection. And that was why I heard about this story first, because there was interest in Ireland through that. And I find they're very, very impressive. You will get a lot of people that say, oh, well, they recanted and they changed their mind at various stages and they said this and this didn't happen. But if you look at the totality of the evidence, it's like in a court case. You can have plenty of doubts, say doubt, but they have to be reasonable doubts in the context of the totality of the evidence. I find her very persuasive. She did, there was two occasions when she was under pressure. One, a few months after, or very quickly after the initial apparition, there was a lot of pressure put on her in Santander to reject this thing. And these are young girls, are not used to the way the world works in that way. And in 1967, for a while, she had, again, there was pressure there's pressure which explains this. She kind of rejected them and then changed her mind. So you do have this. This is utterly consistent with a lot of the apparitions, especially when people are put under severe pressure. But when you compare those times of doubt with the totality of our commitment to this, it just is not sustainable. And severe pressure. And like in La Saleta, I've been reading in French the descriptions of what happened to the seers there. These people are subjected to intense pressure for the whole of their lives in relation to what happened. Can you bless this? Can you do this? Can you? Now, they initially intended to live in the kind of religious orders, but they had visions or they had locutions that they were to have an ordinary life, which is interesting as well, that they were to live a normal life. And she did, and she had her family in New York. So obviously there's a lot of people kind of waiting. They didn't court publicity. And I think in many senses they were very respectful to the church. The messages were given to the church. And in many senses it was for them to do it. Other people took up the cudgel. There was a chap called Joey Lomagino, who was inspired by Padre Pio, who expressing belief in it to project the message. There was a little controversy about him because they said he would have eyes to see the miracle, but he died, and a lot of people believe that disproves it in some way. I think you have to be careful about these interpretations. There's a lot of other different interpretations of the event. So they led ordinary lives, and my reading of it is that they weren't meant to spend all their time courting publicity. It wasn't what they did. They presented enough evidence. And also, they were forbidden in many ways by the church early on to broadcast the message. They had to get permission to do a famous interview she did with BBC. They did an interview with Irish television as well. But the church was forbidding priests to go and celebrate Mass there for a long time. They were, the local diocese was quite hostile to it or inimical to it. So they're operating in very constrained circumstances. But the gist of it is that they live ordinary lives. Mary Cruz did an interview. She was the youngest one in El Mundo, which I read in the Spanish newspapers, which was presented in a way that indicated she had great skepticism about what had happened. But I'm not particularly convinced by, and that's not new. I think they may not have necessarily represented, but that was rejected by Jacinta and Conchita. And I had the good fortune to meet briefly Jacinta when I was in Garabandal this summer, which was very interesting.
Do you want to talk about that meeting?
It was just very briefly. We went up and we visited the place. Now, I was very interested in getting a sense of the place. Now, you've talked about this in your recent reposted interview about with Shinzen Jung about the witnessing mentality. Now, that's a good description. I try and do that in a range of contexts. It's a thing that's very familiar to me, where you separate an element of your cognitive faculties to be able to witness something and don't be directly involved in it. So sometimes I would do that in contexts where I'm trying to get a sense of how I feel a particular place is. So, I mean, the evidence on Fatima is overwhelming for me, but some of the elements of the place itself is difficult to comprehend with all the concrete, etc. there necessary for huge crowds. It's hard to get a sense for, although you do when you go to the older part and their houses. But Garabandal hasn't been approved, so it's very much the way it was. And there's something very powerful about it. So after being up to the pines and up the Caleca, I had gone by the village many times, actually, but not gone into it when I lived there a long time. And especially because my friends, my good friends, had no interest in anything remotely spiritual. It wouldn't have been the right conditions to do so. When we came back into town, there's this small little square and the church is there and all the places that you see in the various videos. I said, I thought it'd be good to get a book, from the local, if there was a local shop, or they didn't have any books, because that should represent or be approved in some way. So I went into the little shop and I was talking to the woman there in Spanish, and I was asking her a few questions. And I was asking her, did she remember this in particular? Because it's important to talk to people directly. She was a lovely woman, looked very well. She's the same age as Conchita, and that are around the same. So I don't know if she was in their class, and I hope I'm not revealing her age. And but very nice woman. And I asked her and about remembering the events. And very enthusiastic. And then she mentioned to me that Jacinta was in town, and I bought the book that she recommended. And so very briefly went over and met Jacinta, and she kindly came out. I know she must be pestered with people. I didn't kind of knock on the door, and there was another woman outside, and she said, there's a family here, in Spanish, and Jacinta came out, and her daughter was there, and she came out, and I was trying to be in that witness mode, you know, where you try and distance yourself so you perceive what the thing is, or, you know, so you're not so emotionally engaged in a bit of me. I do it regularly in a range of contact, and she came to me, and she presented the cross. Now, these are crosses that were kissed by the Virgin Mary, if you accept the story. So she presented it to me to kiss and put it to my forehead and my heart. And I was trying to be very aware as I could, aware of, did I perceive anything in this thing? That was a part of my thing in it. Now, of course, you know, it's subjective, and I don't believe that you believe everybody and you should believe everybody. I don't believe in that. I think you have to look at evidence, but you still have to rely on first-hand experience and reports and witnesses, etc. So in relation to my sense of contact with that, and accepting that this could happen because the woman herself has magnetic power, or the amount of people that have kissed the thing creates some kind of resonance. What I perceived in the moment, in that moment, in that instant, was spiritual light, as I describe it. Now, that doesn't necessarily mean the light as we see it here. It's what I've described in the mystery of the trap light. It's a noetic force which changes your consciousness in some way, or makes you aware beyond the cognitive. And what was very, very clear to me is that this spiritual light cannot be explained in intellectual terms. That was a particular message. It was usual, warm, and inspiring. So I perceived that, and that particular cognitive aspect of it is that this force is real, but it's not. It's a force to be experienced. It's not a force to be explained. It's a force to be. It's experiential. That the reality of this consciousness is experiential, and that you're meant to experience it. So we get preoccupied sometimes with explaining things, what the doctrine is, the dogma is, and forget about this essential thing. I forget about the contact. She was a very nice woman. It was nice to. She appeared authentic to me. We talked a little bit about Ireland, about her husband had a family from Ireland. Seemed very down to earth. I've read the things she's written. So in relation to my experience of it, I don't have any doubt personally I don't have any reasonable doubt that these things happened and as they were described. I mean, there's so much evidence. I find it difficult to dismiss them. And I think the church has made a mistake. It hasn't made a mistake in its classification. It has made a mistake in failing to do the research, failing to collect the evidence. And when it did collect the evidence, to do so in a way that seemed to have predetermined what the outcome of it is. So they have made a mistake on that, and that will have consequences in the future, I believe, if anything happens. So, of course, if nothing happens, they can say, well, there, I told you so, and they were right. It still doesn't explain away these phenomena that are recorded by a range of people around the world. So, personally, as objectively as I could, accepting that I come from a Catholic background, so accepting, therefore, I have a different perspective than other people, I believe that the phenomena are very authentic, and I'm very open to the thing. So I don't have the same skepticism now that I would have had when I lived there, strangely. And there's a strange symmetry about that. Today I was thinking, well, why did I go? I didn't know anyone when I went to live in Cantabria, Geoffrey. I had been in the north of Spain, but I didn't know anyone that there. So I went there, and I find a kind of curious thing that I have to go back and re-examine. And then when I saw that exactly at the time that I arrived was exactly at the time they had the second commission, supposedly to cure the first one, which had been flawed, but the second one was flawed as well. And I remember asking people, what do you think of this? And hearing a very negative view of it, because they were merely reporting reports that were going around. It shows you how this thing works. And even so, when I turn on Wikipedia today and I look at it, and I can see they got a date wrong, and they can see that they have a couple of facts wrong, and they squash it down, and they say on Wikipedia, I'm not saying that people don't know about this, but a lot of people will rely on things like Wikipedia for information about these things. And they're very, very, it's, you know about that in relation to parapsychology. But it says, for example, this thing, it's quite unbelievable. There is some strange quote about this thing has never been examined by a magician. I don't know. The idea that it should be magicians that are the ones that determine the scientific facts is quite a new departure, but it doesn't surprise me in this in the present context.
Well, James, this has been a very detailed excursion into an amazing set of phenomena. I think our viewers will have many different interpretations, undoubtedly. I welcome people to comment, to make active use of the comment section. I'm sure some people will say it was an egregore, a creation, generated, conjured up by the people involved. In any case, this has been a fabulous accounting of what went on. I think it's food for thought. Whatever your perspective on these kinds of events are, this is food for thought. And once again, I want to thank you for being with me.
Thank you, Geoffrey. And I urge people who are presenting facts or whatever about Garabandal to present them so people can make up their own minds. And that not to necessarily tie them to other particular aspects or religious views. It's not for them to do so if they're communicating a message. Let people make their own of it, whoever they are, because we have to move towards a situation where we're finding common ground. And one important point, the last point, Geoffrey, is that it disturbs me at the moment, one aspect of this process, and shows how we're contributing to this context. That, remember, in the Spanish Civil War, and I talked to old guys when I was over there about the Spanish Civil War, you know, 500,000 people killed, involving you know, a whole range, fascist, communist, Trotskyist, fighting the Stalin, dreadful, distributed war, priests been nuns, plenty killed, communists thrown off the cliff, a dreadful, horrendous event. Even if we look at Mao Zedong, when he's saying about, you know, revolution is no garden party, that the point being that there's a lot of people who seem very prepared to contribute towards a polarizing force in society. Whereas what we have to be doing is to be creating some zone of sensible communication between opposing views. It's legitimate to have different views. We can't, if we're ending up saying that our view is the correct view and no other view is right, it can only lead to two conclusions, a dictatorship or a civil war. Now, if people are, and this applies in a general context, if people are so convinced about their perspective that they're willing to kill for it, it's a dangerous one. And we have to be careful about all our rhetoric, that we leave space in between. We leave for the cartilage between the bones so they don't start rubbing against each other, for the ligaments, for all those little things that are important about manners, respect, the entitlement of someone to have an opposing view. These are all things that we're cutting, we're hocking ourselves at an immense danger. And it's always easy afterwards to see how things happen. In Northern Ireland, the last point, in Northern Ireland, a lot of the Protestant loyalist violent men at the end expressed, I believe, genuine remorse. But they said a lot of them were made afraid by the middle class frightening them, the working class guys that went out and that they were so frightened at what was going to happen that contributed towards a dreadful spiral of violence. So one can start off with, you know, vehement words, but there's a next phase that comes that we see from the history of Ireland is when the butchers come, when arguments are over. So at this time, I think it's very, very important for people to be very respectful in relation to how they communicate about their difference and to leave some breathing space in between. So that's the present kind of interpretation to make me twopence halfpenny worth in the context of all this. Thank you again, Jeffrey, and thank you for your openness to allow messages like that. I know a lot of people see religion and all that, and they see it as separate. So I'm not talking about that. We're talking about the phenomena that must be explained. So I appreciate a platform as always, and I know a lot of people have benefited from hearing these discussions. So again, thank you, Jeffrey.
It's always a pleasure to be with you, James. And for those of you watching or listening, thank you for being with us, because you are the reason that we are here. I imagine that by now, many of you already realize that, in conjunction with White Crow Books, we've just launched the new Thinking Aloud Dialogues book imprint, and our first title is There Life After Death? New Thinking Aloud is a nonprofit endeavor. Your contributions to the New Thinking Aloud Foundation make a meaningful difference in our ability to produce new videos.